We now eat the world's best foods and think nothing of it, but this was not always so. In fact, there was a time, not too long ago, when food was rationed and knuckle of pork became the culinary treat. Today we pause for a look back into Grandma's wartime kitchen.
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 539th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Luganville who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards and producer Carol Stafford on the phones. Folks, if you take a quick stroll down the aisles of any supermarket, you will see the best foods the world has to offer, and plenty of it. But it was not always so. In fact, there was a time, way back there between 1942 and 1945, that good food was hard to find, and what you could find was rationed. I came to learn of this time while writing an oral history of World War II in the Pacific called Tales from a Tin Can. As I interviewed World War II vets and their spouses for this book, I came to truly admire their character and wondered about the relationship of what they had to go through to their character. Very recently, I came across a reference to another book about World War II, Grandma's Wartime Kitchen by Joanna Lamb Hayes, and I thought, well, this has to be a perfect Food Chain show, so here we are, with the question of today being, what will we eat if times get tough again? Here to talk with us about this issue, we have Joanna Lamb Hayes herself, who is the author of Grandma's Wartime Kitchen, and also a new book, Recipe from America's Small Farms. Joanne, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you.
So, how did you come to write Grandma's Wartime Kitchen?
Well, it's a really short story. I have worked for many years as a food editor at different magazines, and now as a contributor to magazines. And I went to a conference once, and the keynote speaker said, when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, American women left the kitchen and never came back. And I thought, that's crazy. You know, I was in the kitchen. I wasn't very big, but I was in the kitchen when that happened, and my kitchen was very busy. Mm-hmm. So I started going back to magazines and cookbooks and cooking pamphlets of the time period. And there were all these wonderful recipes that people were certainly cooking. And when you read the advice that was given in magazines, women certainly were not given permission to leave the kitchen, no matter what else they were doing.
That they always had to do, right?
Right,
You can be Rosie the Riveter, but you still have to cook the breakfast, right?
You still had to have three cooked meals a day provided to your family somehow. And as the war started, the information...
You were a tyke in the kitchen then, kind of,
yeah,
at your mother's apron strings, kind of watching from that perspective?
As I remember it, I spent a lot of time under the table.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great big table, and my mother was a school teacher, so she got a lot of extra work during that time period, although she had been told she could never work again when I was born. But suddenly she could work, and my grandmother came to stay with us. And one of my aunts, who was a nurse, came to stay with us because her husband was in the Philippines. So the three of them cooked all the time.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I guess we really miss in modern times, right, is a kitchen full of cooks.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, the whole family.
Well, World War II is a particularly interesting time compared to anything that we know of today, because it was a period of time in which everybody was involved. Whether
uh-huh.
you wanted to or not, we all got involved in the war. Today's wars are kind of like these brush wars that we fight in distant parts of the world, and we look at them, but they really don't touch us to the extent that World War II did. What happened to food, you know, at the advent of World War II, Joanne?
Well, what happened was somewhat based on what had happened during World War I. They had what they called voluntary rationing during World War I, and it simply didn't work. And the day
How would voluntary rationing right. work anyway?
Why would?
Yeah.
But the day after Pearl Harbor, American cooks ran out and bought all the sugar that was available.
So remembering what happened in World
right,
War I.
Yeah, okay. That it was not available for a long period of time during the First World War. So the government immediately decided that the food situation had to be handled differently this time around. And they did a poll of people all over the country. And the people said that they would prefer rationing to having prices increase so that only rich people could have certain things, and to having unequal distribution so that some people...
So kind of in World War II, the rich people got that could afford to buy the food got it.
In World War One, yeah.
In World War One,
yeah.
And then in World War II, they said, well, wait a minute, let's do this more, a little more equitably so that at least everybody has the same shot.
Right, mm-hmm. And they one of the first things to be rationed was sugar.
Why is that?
A great deal of our sugar was coming from the islands, and they needed the ships for transportation for war products. And also, a lot had come from the Philippines, and at one point during the war, we totally lost contact with the Philippines.
Very early in
and
the war,
certainly were not able to get any products from them.
So we were getting our sugar from sugar cane, essentially, then.
We were, and sugar beet production in the South in the U.S. was not very heavy because they hadn't been able to compete price-wise
with sugar cane.
Sugar cane.
Right.
So, but sugar rationing had to do with white refined sugar.
Right.
So
they didn't really have high fructose corn syrup back then, did they?
They did.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, that was the start of corn syrup. I don't know whether it was high fructose, but there was definitely corn syrup, and that was one of the secret ingredients that everyone started using. Mm-hmm. Corn syrup and molasses and honey, and you could get brown sugar was more easily available. You could get brown sugar. But one of the fun things that people decided to do was to use some of manufacturer's sugar supply. So they would put like a package of gelatin mix in a cake, and the sugar would have been used, the points for that sugar would have belonged to General Foods or whoever prepared the mix. And they got a whole lot more points than individual families.
Before we go into the actual specific foods, how did rationing work? What is the mechanism for, they have ration books, coupons, how did it work?
Well, starting at the beginning, teachers were, I don't think they volunteered, I think they were told that they were the committee that handed out ration books. And there were several kinds of rationing. Not all of them applied to food. The two kinds that applied to food, one was like sugar, where everybody got a certain amount. Every man, woman, child was allowed to have a certain amount, and the amount changed weekly depending on the amount that was available.
Did you have coupons or something?
You did. You had a sugar book with coupons.
So everybody got a sugar book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the next round of rationing was point rationing, and that was for things like butter and meat and canned things. And there, the points varied. Like, if you wanted a steak, it was going to cost you a whole lot of points.
Ah.
But if you were willing to have liver, it wasn't going to cost as much, point-wise.
That's a dirty lowdown trick,
right?
That's a dirty lowdown trick.
So,
and if you wanted pig knuckles...
Free. Points. Yep.
So no points.
Right. Things that were easily raised in this country and were not high priority to send to Europe and to the services were not rationed. Mm-hmm. So
the civilian population was really giving in order that the military men could have food. I mean,
and also to support our allies in Europe.
So we were sending a lot of food
to Europe
as well.
We started sending food to Europe in 1938, before we were really considered part of the war. And that's one of the reasons why canning got to be so, home canning got to be so important, because the government rationed commercially canned things, because canned things were easy to ship. They could send those to the allies in Europe, and they could also send those to the armed forces.
Well, Joanne,
fresh things were very difficult to ship.
We're going to take a quick break right now. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about when things were tough back in World War II, and what on earth did we eat when it was hard to find a lot of good food like we could find today. Regrettably, we can't take your phone calls right now, but we can always host you on the Food Chain page at metroforum.com. We will be right back, so please do stay tuned with Joanna Lamb Hayes. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking with Joanna Lamb Hayes, author of Grandma's Wartime Kitchen and Recipes from America's Small Farms. And, you know, talk about recipes from America's... We're talking about a time when it was tough to get a lot of good food. You know, we walk down the supermarket aisles today and we see shelves well stocked with everything, but there was a time back in World War II and those things were hard to get, and you had to pay for them with coupons and points. As things were rationed, as they are not today. So we're looking back on those times to see what people did to survive and get by, and the mechanisms for rationing, and they're wondering what we would eat today if things got tough again for us. As I said, we're speaking with Joanna Lamb Hayes. Joanna, you also came out with a book on recipe from America's Small Farms. Weren't we, back in World War II, much more of an agrarian society than
Definitely.
We are today?
Yes, yes. And almost everyone had a backyard if they didn't live on a farm, and they were used to having a backyard garden, even in cities where it was just a small plot of land that was very efficiently used for a garden, because people had been doing that during the First World War and certainly during the Depression.
Mm-hmm. And so that food was much closer than it is today anyway, wasn't it?
It really was, and the Victory Garden Program was one of the most successful government programs during the war. It really did produce a great deal of the food that America used, particularly during the winter months.
So the government really got behind the Victory Garden Program. They sponsored it, kind of, and encouraged the population to grow their own.
They started putting out information on this a month or so after Pearl Harbor, so that people would start buying the seeds and planting as soon as that first spring came. Mm-hmm. And this was also a program that had been done during World War One. It was called War Garden Program. And when the war was over, it was changed to Victory Garden. So with the Second World War, it started out as the Victory Garden Program. And in 1942, the summer of 1942, it did pretty well. But the summer of 1943 did remarkably well. And there were government stations where people could go with their already to can vegetables, and they could use pressure canners. They would have their jars and everything ready. And
kind of community canning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So everybody really got behind this. By 1943, the country had kind of mobilized its food production as it has had mobilized its war production at
mm-hmm.
the same time. Everybody was very, very... Everybody was focused back then, weren't they?
Very much so. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Kind of on the same team as opposed to the way we are today, where we're also divided. We talk a lot about the different things that were rationed, and we came up with the first thing to be rationed was sugar, mostly because it was hard to get from the islands where most of it was produced. We went from what today we're right about 4 cups of sugar per week, and during World War II we were down to 1/2 cup per week.
Mm-hmm.
What impact did that have on our diet?
Not a whole lot nutritional impact on
our
diet.
I know there are a lot of
people found alternate sources.
Uh-huh. Like such as what?
Sodas, you know, like using ginger ale or Coca-Cola in a cake for the sugar. As I mentioned before, using pudding mixes and gelatin mixes in cakes to provide the sugar and in desserts to provide the sugar, using honey, molasses, corn syrup, all of those things that were produced in America and were easier to get.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the things that were packaged already with sugar. There are a lot of people today who say we should probably go back to 1/2 cup of sugar per week, right?
That's probably true, yes. From a nutritional standpoint.
If you take one look at the people walking down the street and think, well, maybe we should go back to that. What about meat? Was meat possible to get a steak if you wanted it?
It was possible. It cost a lot, and it required a lot of points. And what people would do is, for a special occasion, like a family would pull their points and get steaks or get a roast or get something for a holiday meal. And
Each person had points then?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the larger your family, the more points you would
right.
combine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, even babies had points.
Ah. So points became currency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but people learned to use variety meats that were not rationed or were very low in points.
What would those be?
Well, like a stuffed beef heart, for example, was a fine Sunday dinner instead of a standing rib roast. Not exactly what you'd think of today as a company meal, but... And
we also learned to make mock roasts and things, right? Now, what were those?
Like the Spam turkey, that's very famous.
Spam turkey.
Yes.
Was Spam a World War II invention?
You know, I should really look that up. I'm pretty sure that it was available well before World War II. It's mm-hmm. just that it was pork, so it was easily available in this country. They produced a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. So, and then they would have campaigns, so public awareness campaigns, like "Eat Beans for Democracy,"
right?
"Know Your Soybean."
Mm-hmm.
What was the purpose of those?
You know, soy was one of the things that surprised me the most when I started looking into what people ate during the Second World War, because I wrote this book at about the time when soy was hot. And people were writing whole cookbooks on soy, and everyone seemed to have the idea that it was a today thing. We had just discovered it. And during World War II, there was a lot of promotion of soy products for added protein. In Grandma's Wartime Kitchen, I have soy meatloaf and some cookies that have soy flour in them. I have chili that's made with cooked soybeans. So it was really very well known in the 40s. Sort of faded for a little while then.
Mm-hmm. So they really came. Soybeans really came on in the 40s, and then
they're so high in protein.
Mm-hmm. And then
so
with
it
the
was
advent
used as
of
a meat substitute or as a meat extender.
So and then with the advent of vegetarianism, it kind of has a resurgence.
Mm-hmm.
Then. Good. What about butter?
Butter was rationed with the second round of rationing, where you had to pay a certain number of points for things. And people did a lot of different things. At that point, margarine was already around, but in many states, margarine was not allowed to be colored. So it was white, and which wasn't very appealing to people. Sometimes people would color it themselves. And when I go out to speak to groups, one of the first things that people remember is the package of white margarine with a little button in it that you popped, and then you kneaded the package until it was all yellow.
Why was it against the law to color margarine?
It was something that dairy producers had managed to get through
mm-hmm.
Certain state congresses.
Only butter can look like butter,
right?
Right,
yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
good.
Yeah, I know that I went to summer camp at that time, and we would have a great big pound-shaped brick of white stuff on the table, and we used to call it cold cream.
Cold
and
cream?
It was just uncolored margarine.
Uh-huh.
But as a joke, we called it cold cream. Pass the cold cream.
What did we miss most?
When you ask people about that, sugar and butter, they tend to be the things that they mentioned first. I have read surveys that said that men missed steak most and women missed sugar most.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how true that is, but...
But it's probably a good guess, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It sounds plausible.
Sounds plausible. Okay, folks, mm-hmm. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about when times were a little bit tougher, as they were in World War II, 1942, 1945, World War II years, and how people had to sacrifice across the board, those who were serving in the military, those who were civilians at home. Everybody had to pitch in to a certain extent to win the war, and everybody did. We're talking about our relationship with food during those years and what it was like and how we coped. You can always join us this week on the Food Chain page at MetroForum.com. We have Joanna Lamb Hayes, who is the author of Grandma's Wartime Kitchen and Recipes from America's Small Farms, right back. Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about when times were tough, World War II, and how we had to ration our food and what it was like for us when we had to ration food and pay for food with points and coupons. And we have Joanna Lamb Hayes with us, who is the author of Grandma's Wartime Kitchen. What happened with the restaurants, Joanna? Did they have to go through some pretty tough times as well?
Well, they didn't have exactly the same rationing system, but they did certainly have tougher times than they had before. They would do things like having a wartime special and did a lot of meals that were high in vegetables and things like that. Gourmet magazine was had just been started in January of 1941.
Hmm,
and
good timing.
They never chose to do war-related articles. And at one point they were asked why, and they said that they only want to focus on good food and that there's a lot of good food that can still be made within the lists of things that are available. And then they reminded people how the French are very good at using variety meats, and that some of your most famous French dishes have sweetbreads and liver and kidneys and things like that. So I think that some upscale restaurants went that route as well.
So it was still possible to get food
in
good restaurants. So,
mm-hmm.
So the family could still go out to a Sunday dinner at a restaurant, although it might cost a lot in terms of money and whatnot those days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how did people cope then? I mean, you talked a little bit about how they invented different kinds of dishes, stuffed beef heart, for example. What else did they do to cope, get along?
They figured out lots of ways of extending things. If they had ground beef, they would put a lot of shredded vegetables into them to make beef patties. Another trick was
What kind of vegetables?
Oh, like carrots and even potatoes,
mm-hmm.
Shredded onions and things like that, which gave a lot of flavor as well.
Right. Kind of made a meatloaf out of it then.
Sort of, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What about things like cottage cheese fondue and squash biscuits and oatmeal goulash?
Mm-hmm. Those are all good, hearty, healthy foods. So if you can just season them a little bit differently, it'll fill up your family and still be good for them. One of the big problems that the government discovered at the beginning of the war was the very poor nutritional state of the American public, because as they were drafting people, there were a lot of people who failed the health test for the draft because they were had not had decent food during the Depression, and they were not healthy enough to go into the service. So they were very concerned about that and started a big nutrition program to teach everyone what was good for you.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of that was good-for-you things that aren't necessarily expensive or rationed.
Like?
Vegetables. All kinds.
And things you
oatmeal.
Could grow in your victory garden.
Yeah.
Anything you could grow in your victory garden was...
Okay. Oatmeal and wheat and bread.
What about the rationing of liquor?
Was liquor
readily available during those times?
American-made liquor, spirits was available. Wine was a little harder to come by. There were not a lot of wineries, except there were some in California. There had been a great many wineries all over America until Prohibition, and then most of those were closed unless they found some alternate way of making a living until that was over. So there really was not a large supply of wine, and people did start making wine at home
mm-hmm.
out of all sorts of things. Dandelion wine, cherry wine.
Kind of like they did in Prohibition, probably.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
right.
yeah.
And what about the black market? I mean, whenever you restrict the flow of something, you create, you change the price structure of it and make it incredibly more valuable. And
mm-hmm.
and one would assume that if things were rationed and hard to get, that there would have been a black market springing up to supply those goods.
I think the most famous black market was tires. But certainly food-wise, there was a black market in beef and in sugar. And the government had lots of posters, the big poster campaign, to encourage people not to support the black market.
Yes. Go hungry. Don't buy that beef from the neighbor. What about buying from neighbors?
That was somehow allowed, and I'm not exactly sure to what extent...
How you would control something like
right.
that.
Right. I mean, because people living in the country certainly did buy half a cow from a neighbor when they were butchering. One very interesting thing that my mother told me, and then I found recipes for it in magazines and included it in here, was that she, when she was able to get steaks, she would cook them and she would put them in a crock and she would pour boiling hot lard over them to cover them up. So, and then keep them in the basement. And when she wanted to use them, she would pull them out of the lard and just heat them up.
Hmm. And they were already cooked.
They were already cooked, yeah. And because there was no air getting to them, they were apparently safe. Sounded a little scary to me, but...
But they did manage then. What about hoarding? Then we talked a little bit.
That was another thing that the government had campaigns about. There's some very cute posters. If people are interested in seeing some of the World War II posters, they really tell you a whole lot about what people were told to do. There's a great collection at Northwestern University's website.
Oops, wait a minute. We have to... Oh, we're okay. Go ahead. Go ahead.
So just search for Northwestern University poster collection.
And
you can see a number of these. And hoarding and avoiding the black market were two of the big themes that the government made many, and usually mm-hmm. funny posters. It would be quite stuffy-looking people handing the butcher extra money under the counter, and the poor mama with her babies there was not getting any, and things like that. So
you know, we have this notion of going to the neighbor to borrow a cup of sugar. I reckon that could have been a time when that cup of sugar would have been very valuable, right?
Mm-hmm.
In World War
yeah.
II. I mean, borrowing a cup of sugar from the neighbor could have been quite a gesture then.
Like borrowing a diamond today.
Yeah.
I interviewed a number of people who had been cooking during that time period. And one woman told me that she had to collect the sugar coupons from her whole family and give them to the baker in order to get her wedding cake.
There you go. Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about rationing food, as we did in World War II. We're talking with Joanna Lamb Hayes, who is the author of Grandma's Wartime Kitchen and Recipes from America's Small Farms. Today you can participate with us by logging on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. There's a forum there. Dig in and have a good time. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about today. What we learned back then can be applied to today. Right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about rationing food as we did in World War II and what we learned from those times and if what we learned can make any difference today. Joanna Lamb Hayes, I remember my grandmother's root cellar up in Belfry, Montana on a farm, and it was truly an amazing place. It was filled with jars and jars and jars of delicious-looking canned foods that she took from her garden. And, you know, being wartime people, they survived the war on a farm and probably did pretty good because they had access to all of the food you can possibly imagine there on the farm. But what about the city people? Did they have access, the same kind of access, or were they close to the earth, close enough to the earth to grow their own things?
Well, Victory Gardens were encouraged in the city, and some brownstones certainly had backyards that at least the people on the first couple floors had access to. My grandmother lived in Philadelphia during the war, and her kitchen door went out onto the roof of the part of the building that was the floor below her, and she had pots of stuff out there. So they could raise some things like that. As a symbol of encouraging people to do so, the gardens in the center of Rockefeller Center were turned into Victory Gardens, and they raised corn and tomatoes and in those gardens that now have the angels in the Christmas time. And
they probably had some pretty good horticulture people work in those gardens,
yeah,
too, right?
and some people stopping by at night to have some probably did. As well. But,
well, that raises an interesting question. What about thieves? What about, just food thieves?
Sure a great deal of that happened as well, that people would drive out into the country and take things from
poach a cow
field.
Or whatever, yeah.
Mm-hmm. However, there was a lot more sharing in those days. The town that I was raised in had a number of canning factories. And the canning factories would harvest all day, and then they would declare a field open when they were finished with it.
So you could glean.
And then everyone went out, and the whole family would go and with your little baskets and pick up things that had fallen or things that were missed by the automated pickers. And So that was certainly the way we got most of our green beans and also some of our tomatoes.
So there was just a lot more food going around.
Fewer people in America.
Well, Joanna, I'm sure that you've considered the question, having written a book about grandma's wartime kitchens, and looked at the difference between our country in 1940s and our country in the 2000s. We're a lot different country. We're a lot more urban. We live in the city. Only 2% of us now live on farms. Have you considered what it would be like today if we were to go through hard times again?
I think the government regulation would have to be a lot different. But one of the things that impressed me throughout writing and researching this book was the way women's roles during that time period are so similar to their roles today, where they are working full-time. They're still expected to raise the children and to have a nutritious dinner on the table at night. So, I mean, there was a time period in between when that was not so. But now the responsibilities that women carry in this world seem to be quite as heavy as they were during the Second World War.
So during the Second World War, one of the ways we really got by was by mobilizing, essentially,
mm-hmm.
women.
Definitely, yeah.
So we double-shifted our women, but now our women are already double-shifted.
Mm-hmm.
So where would we get our women?
I don't have a clue. They already have.
They're already.
Cases,
they're already
young
double.
Women already have jobs.
Yeah, they're already working. They're already raising a family, and they're already cooking the dinners. Or
mm-hmm.
if they have a stooge like me, they have a husband that helps out on some of those things. But
mm-hmm.
I mean,
we do have one big resource that I think is underused these days in America, and that's people over 65. They were certainly recognized as a possible workforce during the Second World War, and that might be a way we would have to go again.
Mm-hmm. So if we did get into a bind, we could look to senior citizens?
Yeah.
Put them out there in the world.
Who
in
many cases are looking for something good to do.
Yeah. They can hoe some weeds, right? So,
well, if not that, they can certainly do office and computerized manufacturing jobs and the kind of things that women were recruited for during the Second World War.
Rosie the Riveter kind
mm-hmm.
of kind of jobs.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, you've since writing Grandma's Wartime Kitchens, you've come off with another book. And this one is kind of about the relationship of cities to farms. It's called Recipes from America's Small Farms. And you talk about, farmers markets and community-supported agriculture, right?
Yes. I've been very interested in co-oping.
We have to take a quick break, Joanna.
Okay.
But when we come back, I want to talk about the relationship of farms to cities and perhaps bringing back that relationship that we once enjoyed so much, especially during the years of 1940s and 1950s. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking a little bit about what happened when times are tough in World War II with Joanna Lamb Hayes, author of Grandma's Wartime Kitchen and Recipe from America's Small Farms. It was a big difference in our worlds from 1940s to the 2000s. We were a rural people back then. We're a metropolitan people now. So where can we get our food if we get into some tough times again? A tough question for some tough people. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson right back. Please do stay tuned. We're back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking with Joanna Lamb Hayes, author of Grandma's Wartime Kitchens, Recipes, and Recipes from America's Small Farms. It was a rural time back in World War II. In writing Tales from a Tin Can, I learned that most of the good sailors came from the farm country of America, and most of those kids were extremely poor during those years. And so when the war was over, they all moved into town and took jobs in the city, and we became a city-dominated world. So what happens, Joanna, if we go through hard times again and we no longer have that agricultural base that we once had before? Are we still going to be able to eat?
I think we're going to have to think seriously about that. And I think the problem with the pet food recently is something that might instigate some of that thought. We're so dependent on other parts of the world, and we don't even have the system in place to carefully examine the things that we get from other parts of the world.
I guess I just read today where 1.3% of all of the food that comes into the United States is looked at. And that's all.
Yes, and a whole lot of that is rejected.
Right.
But the rest of it isn't even looked at. So that's quite a problem.
So we've become essentially much more I guess dependent on others to feed ourselves,
mm-hmm.
whereas during the war years of 1940s, we were really a can-do people, and we took care of each other. And you've been working with small farms and their relationships to the city. Do you think that those small farms can serve as the basis for, you know, a way of taking charge of our lives again?
They can certainly serve as a basis for it, but I think one of the things that people don't understand about food production in the U.S. now is the cost of keeping a farm going. Part of the reason that I got into doing this book, I've been working with co-ops for like maybe 30 years, and maybe more than that actually. I started in the 60s in Detroit, and got things from a co-op that bought from the wholesale market there, just fruits and vegetables and a dozen eggs every week. And then when I moved to New York, I started was part of a group that started a food co-op in mm-hmm. the building that I live in. And that lasted for a number of years. And recently then, let's say the last 8 to 10 years, I've been a member of a community-supported agriculture group. And there are now more than 35 of those sites in Manhattan. We support an organic farm that's in Greene County, New York, and they drive in once a week with
So we're
our
already
produce.
Taking you're already taking charge, aren't you? You're already developing these relationships that we might need should times become tough again.
Uh-huh. Well, personally I have chosen to do this, and I keep trying to encourage other people to do it as well. That was partly the reason for this book. Because we wanted more people to learn about community-supported agriculture.
And that's the way to do it. Joanne mm-hmm. Lamb Hayes, we want to thank you so much for joining us today, folks. This has been The Food Chain. Joanna's books, Grandma's Wartime Kitchen, also Recipes from America's Small Farms. Tune in, enjoy it, and think about what you're going to eat if times get tough again. Thank you so much for tuning in. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.